The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But first, tensions in the Middle East have reached a high after US military strikes destroyed three Iranian nuclear sites, although the extent of the damage yet to be really assessed. Following the attacks, several senior Iranian military leaders have threatened to respond to the US. Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps spokesman Ibrahim Zolfagari says the US has directly entered the war and violated the sacred soil of Iran. He says the US will face heavy, regrettable and unpredictable consequences through powerful and targeted operations.
Gambler Trump, you can start this war, but we will be the ones who end it.
Back on U.S. soil, the Trump administration called the attacks a spectacular success. Now, Vice President J.D. Vance spoke to ABC's John Carl on the This Week program yesterday, and Carl played for him two clips from President Trump, one from election night and the other from his inauguration.
I'm not going to start a war. I'm going to stop wars. We will measure our success not only by the battles we win, but also by the wars that we end, and perhaps most importantly, the wars we never get into.
So let me ask you, what do you say to those, including some of the president's strongest supporters, who are really worried this morning that the United States is now involved in yet another protracted war, conflict, whatever you want to call it, in the Middle East?
Well, first of all, John, I think the president has been very clear that we are not interested in protracted conflicts in the Middle East, but there's a question about how do you achieve peace, and we believe the way that you achieve peace is through strength. We took a very narrow and limited approach to destroying the Iranian nuclear program, John. That's what the president did, and I think that, more than anything, is going to ensure peaceful resolution in that region of the world. You can't be weak. You can't sit there and allow the Iranians to achieve a nuclear weapon, John, and expect that's going to lead to peace. It would lead to absolutely disastrous military conflict all over the Middle East. And so I'd say to people who are worried about a protracted military conflict is, number one, the president, more than anybody, is worried about protracted military conflicts. That is not what we're getting ourselves involved in. What we're getting ourselves involved in is a very targeted effort to eliminate the Iranian nuclear program. That will continue to be the goal of American foreign policy, and it's that goal that is going to motivate our action in the weeks and months to come.
So that was J.D. Vance speaking yesterday in the United States. I'm joined by Alistair Campbell, host of The Rest is Politics and former Downing Street Director of Communications and Strategy for Tony Blair. But first, Shashank Joshi, defense editor with The Economist. Shashank, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Now, first of all, already the Iranians are saying that, yes, the targets were hit, but they're already beginning to rebuild. Is that just hyperbole, you know, some sort of saving of face? Or do you think that the damage done to those nuclear sites was not as emphatic and, I suppose, destructive as Donald Trump would like to think?
Well, I mean, let's be clear. Fordow is a mountain. You're not going to evaporate a mountain with bombs. But what you can do is put out of action the stuff within it. And if you drop 14 30,000-pound bombs on a single site using its ventilation shafts and entrance tunnels, there is very little chance, I think, that the machines inside, which spin uranium at very high speed, centrifuges, that they're going to survive. They're very sensitive to vibration. And I think there's a pretty good chance America's severely damaged, if not destroyed, what's inside. However, it's important to recognize the Iranian nuclear program isn't just one big set of machines. It's a lot of things. And I think one of the big questions right now is not the centrifuges inside Fordow. It is the one of the other sites that America struck, Esfahan. That's where Iran used to store its stockpile of highly enriched uranium, uranium enriched to 60%, which is very near weapons grade. And we don't know where that is. You know, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, used to monitor it, but it has no visibility now. And we've heard yesterday from J.D. Vance, the vice president, suggesting America may not be sure where it is. And that, I think, is a pretty serious concern that the strikes may not have addressed.
And in addition, there was a convoy of trucks leaving Fordow before the weekend, before the strikes took place. We don't know what those trucks contained or where they went.
We don't. You know, it's possible in theory they could have disassembled centrifuges and taken out some of the machines. I think that's relatively unlikely because these are not just machines you turn a switch and flat pack them up. You know, it's you've got uranium gas inside them. inside lots of connected centrifuges called cascades. And it's actually very difficult and time-consuming to take these apart and move them. But however, if there was enriched uranium that came out the other end, is it possible Iran may have moved it from Fordow? There were also trucks, in addition, seen, I think, at Isfahan. That's entirely possible. So we don't know for sure. Now, given Israel's intelligence penetration of Iran that we've seen in such spectacular fashion over the last 10 days, is it possible the Israelis know exactly where this stuff is, where it's being moved, where it's gone, and they're avoiding striking it for environmental reasons and for health reasons and looking until it's settled at a particular place? That's possible. That is possible. So we just don't know the details at the moment. But there is some troubling, you know, material potentially out there whose location is not fully understood to us.
Now, Iran has promised revenge and retribution, saying that Donald Trump started this war. He entered the war, if you like, unilaterally. And they were at pains to point out that this was an American operation. I presume Donald Trump wanted to take credit for it. It wasn't an Israeli operation, but they just made sure they stayed out of their way in the skies. There were no Israeli fighter jets or whatever as the stealth bombers approached. But what is that retribution likely to look like for the United States?
Well, you know, the worst case, of course, is that Iran still has lots of short and medium range ballistic missiles that are more numerous and more accurate, probably, over those ranges than the ones that Iran has been using to strike Israel. And it could do real damage to American facilities and American interests. It could also disrupt international energy markets by mining or otherwise seeking to close the Strait of Hormuz, which is the only passageway between the Persian Gulf and the open ocean. However, just because something is possible doesn't mean it's likely. And I think it is important to recognize that this is a moment of extreme weakness for the Iranian government, that they need to save face and show that they're responding, but they will also wish to avoid severe retribution against the regime itself from America. And I would cast your mind back to 2020, to those American assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general. And the Iranian response then was to strike a U.S. base in Iraq. But it did so in a very symbolic way. It telegraphed the attack. It effectively gave advance notice. I'm told that it didn't encrypt the radio signals going to and from the missile, allowing America to see where it was heading. So we could see that kind of visibly very robust Iranian response, but one that's designed in practice not to cause mass casualties or serious damage. And that could be a way of calibrating Iran's response and keeping it within limits while also saving the regime's honor to some degree.
And finally, Shashanka, I should ask you about the reaction in the rest of the Middle East. It's been characterized as Iran having no friends at all in the Middle East, in the other Gulf states, for instance, and in the wider area. Is that simply down to Shia-Sunni differences, or is it something else?
Well, no, I don't think it's just that, of course. You know, it's more complicated. Iran backs a number of, Arab and or Sunni militant groups. We see that very clearly, for example, in Hamas. Hamas is not a Shia group, although you know, obviously Hezbollah and some of the Iraqi militias are. But I think really what you see is, although Iran may not have any great friends, the Gulf states are nonetheless terrified right now that the retaliation will get them caught in the crossfire. And if you think about Dubai, think about these big Gulf cities, imagine the impact on investor confidence, on political confidence of a missile going into a skyscraper. So from their perspective, they don't like Iran. They're afraid of Iran, but they also are deeply concerned that this will escalate in ways that undermines their basic political and social model in the Gulf. And I think they want to see a de-escalation as soon as possible.
Shashank Joshi, thank you very much for joining us, defense editor with The Economist. Listening to all of that, Alistair Campbell. Alistair, good morning.
Hi, Pat.
Now, you had an emergency podcast, I suppose, overnight from The Rest is Politics with Rory Stewart. Looking at all the coverage yesterday, there were interesting reactions. Malcolm Rifkind, I saw him on Sky, very much pro, saying Donald Trump did the right thing, the only thing to do. John Bolton, who has fallen out with Donald Trump but was in his first administration before he was dumped, also saying doesn't agree with Trump on a lot of things, but this was the right thing to do. And then you had the military, all the military experts sort of gasping in admiration at the audacity and the excellence of the operation itself. I didn't hear much in the way of criticism of the legality or otherwise of the operation.
No, I think that one of the things that Donald Trump has achieved in his short time in his second term is a sense of the communication of his own power. And I think that we've got the NATO summit this week. You'd think that there would be at least some of the European and other NATO member leaders at least sort of paying lip service to the idea of de-escalation, they are saying, but barely anybody, I think with the exception of Ursula von der Leyen, barely anybody even questioning the legality. And that's because of, you talked there with Shashank there about the way that Iranian power is feared in some parts of the world. And it's the same right now with American power. And I think that's actually a problem. I think that the what we're seeing in what's going on in recent weeks is really a breakdown of any of the acceptance of the international order and international institutions that for most of our life we've taken for granted. So the fact that, for example, one of the strongest voices of criticism has been Guterres, Antonio Guterres, the head of the United Nations, but he just sounds so impotent in a way because Trump is making clear he doesn't really care what the United Nations think. And of course, what you've got with, you look at the permanent five on the United Nations, China desperately won't want the Straits of Hormuz to be closed because a lot of its oil goes through there. But equally, will be thinking, well, maybe if Trump can do this and nobody really complains about it, makes my task in relation to Taiwan easier. And in relation to Putin, another member of the permanent five, I mean, we're now in the kind of mad situation where Putin suggests himself to Donald Trump as a possible mediator between Iran and Israel. And even though he's engaged in, you know, one of the bloodiest wars that Europe's seen since the Second World War, Trump sort of takes that at face value. So we're in a very, very, very different world to the one that, you know, even a few years ago we felt we were living in.
Now, how dependent is Russia still on Iranian-made drones, or has it simply bought the technology from Iran and is manufacturing those drones to use against Ukraine itself?
Well, I mean, I don't know is the answer, but what I do know is that Russia and Iran have pretty close links politically, militarily, etc. And you know, I think Putin will be enjoying is the wrong word, but I think Putin will feel that this is a situation that is playing to his benefit in relation to Ukraine. Interesting, I feel two of the big casualties in this, one is Ukraine and one is Gaza, because the, you know, the horror that you and I have talked about before that's going on in Gaza is continuing, but without the international spotlight that it had, even up until recently, because of what's since transpired in relation to Iran. And I noticed Zelensky's comments on Iran. Essentially, he's saying, praising Trump's leadership, because he's basically wants the same sort of, you know, absolutely all-out leadership in relation to stopping Putin in Ukraine. And on the bigger points that you were discussing there with Shashank, and I don't know if Shashank is still listening, but he probably knows that Rory Stewart regularly calls him out as one of the great experts on these issues. But I do think this because of the way that Trump communicates. And J.D. Vance, of course, now sort of wants to echo that style of communication. Everything gets presented as very, very black and white. So, you know, we are completely and totally obliterated their nuclear sites. Well, I don't think they will have completely and totally obliterated their nuclear sites. And when they say this is limited and this is it, it's a one-off and then we move on, they don't know that. Because
is that not simple wishful thinking? And they're saying this because they want to appease the MAGA base who cautioned, some of them who cautioned against going in the first place. So they're saying, oh, this is not against Iran. This is against Iran's nuclear program. I mean, let's cavil on the ninth part of a hair.
Well, Iran's nuclear program is, whether we like it or not, an important part of Iran's sense of its own self and its own strategy for the future. So, for example, I said on the podcast last night that the Iranians look at the they've been pretty clear about saying that the Straits of Hormuz, they won't even think about closing it or partially closing it or mining it or making it more difficult to get supplies through there unless they feel that their own national interest is being threatened. Well, when you've got Trump tweeting about, well, if you can't make Iran great again, what's wrong with regime change? That is quite a threat. And so, but I think what this is the problem with the lack of the lack of respect for alliances, the lack of focus on the build-up. I've just been reading a really interesting piece in the New York Times, which is sort of examining the way that Trump, they're now recalibrating what they've been saying and doing as a sort of great act of genius and feinting and deliberate misinformation and so forth. So when he talked about 2 weeks, that was so that he already knew that he was going to go in 2 or 3 days, but he wanted to take them by surprise, etc. Now, I don't know the truth. I don't know what's actually been said within the American administration. But I think that what they do is to set themselves the line. They hammer the line very, very hard. They get the MAGA base in line. And to be fair, actually, most of them have fallen in line on the back of this. But as you say, by saying this is a one-off. But the trouble with that is that it depends on what the reaction of the Iranians is going to be. Shashank was talking there about some of the things that they might do. Imagine that there were a great cyber hit on America. Would the Americans feel they had to escalate? Maybe. If there was a hit on an American base, say in Iraq or Bahrain or wherever it might be, I don't think there'd be any doubt that Trump would feel he'd have to escalate. And so it depends now on what happens on the other side. They cannot take for granted that just because they say the consequences are as they expect them to be, that that is what will happen. And so I think that, you know, militarily, I think they're right to think this was an extraordinary operation. I mean, it really was. And I think we'll be, you know, studied for years to come about how they did it, the fainting with an E, that is the sending of
B-2s to Guam.
To Guam to make and allowing them to be tracked, whereas the real ones weren't being tracked. And then the precision, we don't know yet the actual consequences of it. But however you look at this, whatever your arguments about legality or anything else, you can't deny that it's an amazing military act. Now, the consequences of that, I think, are still very, very unpredictable.
Yeah. The whole idea of this making the world a safer place because they've destroyed the nuclear possibilities, probably delayed them by several years, because there's no doubt under the current regime, which if it lasts, that nuclear program will be resuscitated. There's no question about that. But moving on to regime change, it's interesting that if regime change comes about on foot of the American involvement, this is an echo of the past, as you and I have mentioned before, when the UK and the US organized a coup in Iran back in the 50s.
Well, I thought you were going to talk about Iraq in 2003 there, but...
No, I know that's another...
That's another one we've talked about a lot in the past as well. I reiterate the point I've just made, is that you cannot accurately predict what is now going to happen. And also, let's just say that there is regime change. What does the regime change to? And that I don't think any of us fully know the answer. You've got, I think, in Iran a really interesting situation where the regime is pretty widely hated. Let's imagine sort of on the one side, you've got a lot of quotes, real people who really don't like the regime and just want Iran to be kind of become a normal functioning country. And then on the other side, in a way, you've got real hardliners who are looking for any sign of weakness in the response. So they are very, very vulnerable. And often what people do when they're very, very vulnerable is they lash out in unexpected directions. And don't forget as well, this is they're limited in what they can do, but that doesn't mean that they won't apply what we would define as irrational thinking to response that they might be putting together. And so I think that when we talk about regime change, and when Trump tweets, you know, if you don't make Iran great again, what's wrong with regime change? Well, what's wrong with regime change? That question depends on what follows. And that, I think, we should be very, very wary of, too.
By the way, in terms of Britain's response to this, I mean, I was reading that since 2022, there have been 20 plots uncovered by MI5, Iranian threats to Britain. And, of course, you're in Cyprus, or were in Cyprus, at the time of a British citizen of Azerbaijani descent spying on the base in Akrotiri in Cyprus. So is Iran a threat, and now an even bigger threat to British interests?
Well, yes, is the answer to that. And I mean, I think the British response has been interesting. You probably heard Rory Stewart on our podcast very, very angry that neither Britain nor France nor Germany has even mentioned the possibility of at least observance of international law and not even having that debate. But I think that, you know, the focus of Keir Starmer's response seemed to me to be about an acceptance of the Iranian threat. Not necessarily, I mean, he says as a fact it would be a danger to the world if Iran got its hand on a nuclear weapons, a nuclear bomb. Now, what he wasn't saying is echoing the American view that this, and the Israeli view that this, is kind of, you know, days, weeks ahead. Back to your earlier point about that, I think that and I know you calibrated it in the discussion with Shashank, but I don't think any of us can know that they've been set back by a year or 2 years, whatever it might be. And if they have, as Shashank seemed to be saying, managed to sort of get their enriched uranium in a place where the Americans have not been bombing in the last few days, then that might give them the thinking. This is what I go back to the point about making whether they're thinking rationally. They might just think, well, you know, we're not as far advanced as we want to be, but we could actually get put together and whack off a dirty nuclear bomb pretty quickly. So this could accelerate them down a road that we don't want them to go down. That's why I say, I think, you know, your program and every program in the world will be getting people like me and Shashank on to give sort of what you would want to be considered and sort of definitive opinions. I think it's impossible to have definitive opinions right now. And that includes if you're the president of the United States or if you're the supreme leader in Iran, because they don't know the consequences of what they're doing right now.
The final point is about that call by European leaders for de-escalation from Merz and Macron and Keir Starmer. You know, it's a bit late. It should have been a call on Trump to de-escalate before he did this. Because the instinct that many of us had is that if he's got a big bunker-busting bomb, he'll use it. That's the nature of the man.
Well, but if you follow that to the next step of that logic, Pat, that means that, you know, if push came to shove, he wouldn't be averse to using a nuclear weapon either.
I think he's terrified of his own death, though, and well, that would be assured.
We've also heard, I wondered whether that, when he was talking about wanting to go down the diplomatic route, and we're not going to take out Khamenei, even though the Israelis say they know where he is. I mean, that could have just been a bit of sort of psychological warfare from Israel. But I wondered then whether that related to this sort of fear of death that Trump has, that people talk about. But I think, look, the guy is so unpredictable. And what you're seeing with world leaders, other world leaders like Merz, Macron, Starmer, Carney, and all the rest of them, is that there's no doubt they're calibrating their response out of a desire, I guess, to think that the limited influence they might have over him will be reduced if they call him out in any way. Now, I'm not convinced that's 100% right, but that is clearly what is driving a lot of their thinking. I saw Albanese's in Australia. His response was quite muted, but absolutely not a word of criticism of Trump. Why? In part because they know that Trump is currently reviewing the AUKUS, the deal between us and the Americans and Australia on future nuclear submarines in Australia. So these are all really big, difficult, complicated issues that most world leaders apply a bit of nuance and a bit of diplomacy. And I'm afraid that's what Trump doesn't do. He doesn't apply the nuance. You know, we've obliterated it. Not, you know, we hope that we've done some significant damage, but we've obliterated it. This has been the greatest military operation ever. Make Iran great again equals regime change. This sort of simple black and white approach, which is very effective in terms of sort of getting people to watch him on the TV and all that stuff, but it doesn't necessarily make for making the world a safer place. And it does seem very, very strange that he seems to be driven at the moment by this obsession about getting a Nobel Peace Prize, while his actions strike me as possibly going in the opposite direction.
Alistair Campbell, co-host with Rory Stewart of The Rest is Politics, former Downing Street Director of Communications and Strategy for Tony Blair. Alistair, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.